the balance between the two. It is like a transition between your lower and upper chakras, between the survival instincts and the instinct toward liberation. It is symbolized by two interlocking triangles, one pointing downward and another upward, forming a six-pointed star. Many religious traditions have used the star as a sacred symbol because some enlightened beings in these cultures realized their original nature through anahata and discovered the interlocking triangles of this chakra within themselves. The Vishuddhi chakra, located at the pit of your throat, literally means filter. If your Vishuddhi becomes powerful, you have the ability to filter everything that enters you. Or in other words, once your Vishuddhi is very active, you grow so powerful that the external nature has no influence over you. Indian iconography depicts Adiyogi, or Shiva, with a blue throat, because he is capable of filtering all the poisons of the outside world and preventing them from entering his system by stalling them in his throat. If your energies move into Agna Chakra, located between your eyebrows, you are intellectually enlightened, but still not experientially liberated. The great mystic philosopher of 8th century India, Adi Shankara, walked all across the land, defeating legions of scholars in metaphysical debate. His logic was unbeatable, because the union experienced in Agna endows one with an extraordinary level of intellectual insight and perception. The seventh chakra, Sahasrara, is actually located just outside the body. For most people, it is dormant. Through spiritual practice or a very intense way of living, you can activate this. If you hit your Sahasrara, your experience is no longer intellectual. It is experiential. You now explode into unexplained ecstasies, and the deepest mystical realms start opening up. Sometimes you can attain ecstasies that can turn uncontrollable if there is not sufficient spiritual practice to create necessary physiological and psychological balance. In the yogic tradition, these ecstatic mystics were termed avadhutas. They were in such altered states of consciousness that they often had to be fed and taken care of by those around them because they were incapable of handling the worldly aspects of life on their own. Fundamentally, any spiritual path can be described as the journey from the Mooladhara to the Sahasrara, an evolution from one dimension to another. There is a wide spectrum of spiritual practices in the yogic system that enables one to move one's energies from one chakra to another. However, from the Agna to the Sahasrara, there is no path. You must either leap or fall into it. This is one of the reasons for tremendous emphasis on a living guru in the yogic tradition. To make the leap from Agna to the Sahasrara takes immense trust. Suppose you are confronted by a bottomless abyss and someone asked you to plunge into it. You would either have to be utterly crazy, extraordinarily courageous, or absolutely trusting to do it. Almost no one has the kind of courage it takes. Very few are mad enough to live their lives with total abandon. Most people live with caution and the overriding need to protect their boundaries. So for a 99.9% of the people, what is needed is trust. Without trust, they will never make the leap. However, the abyss need not conjure dark images of a terrifying pit. Instead, it signifies a space free of all possibility of hurt and suffering, an entirely new dimension that is flawlessly non-repetitive, a dimension beyond comparison, and context that leaves you not as an individual, but as all-encompassing, infinite nature, in a stillness beyond bliss. And so, the leap is worth it. The leap is everything. With the leap, the bottomless abyss becomes boundless freedom. Sadhana. By focusing at a point 6 to 9 inches away from the region between your eyebrows for 12 to 48 minutes, with your eyes open, you can realize the nature and structure of your individual chakras, depending on the duration and level of your focus. This perception can help in stabilizing the random movement of chakras in the human physiology due to stressful external situations. This is just one aspect of a very sophisticated form of Kriya Yoga that allows you access to your inner Akashic or etheric dimension. Uncharted path. The sixth limb of yoga is referred to as dhyana or dhyan, which is essentially about transcending the boundaries of one's physical and mental framework. Dhyan traveled from India to China along with the Buddhist monks, where it was referred to as chan. This yoga traveled through Southeast Asian countries to Japan and became Zen, and found expression as a whole system of direct insight without an emphasis on doctrine. Zen is a spiritual path that has no scriptures, books, rules, or rigid practices. It is an uncharted path. The first recorded use of the method we now call Zen happened almost 8,000 years ago, well before the time of Gautama the Buddha. King Janaka was a brilliant man, an ardent seeker, burning with the longing to know. He had exhausted all spiritual teachers in the kingdom. None of them could help him because they were all born out of the book. He had still to meet someone who came from inner experience. One day the king went on a hunting trip. Riding deep into the jungle, he caught sight of a yogi. He stopped. Seated outside a small hermitage was Ashtavakra, one of the most accomplished yogis and spiritual masters of all time. Janaka prepared to get off the horse to greet him. He swung his leg over the saddle and was about to dismount when Ashtavakra said, "Stop." So Janaka stopped right there, one leg still in the stirrup and the other mid-air. It was a painful position to be in, but Janaka stayed frozen, staring at Ashtavakra. We don't know how long the guru held him that way, but suddenly, in that awkward state, Janaka became fully enlightened. The method employed by Ashtavakra was akin to what is generally known in the world as Zen today. Once it happened, there was a Zen master whom everyone respected, but who had no teaching to impart. He always carried a huge sack on his shoulders. This would contain many items, and some of it would be sweets. In every town and village that he visited, children would gather around him, and he would distribute sweets and leave. People asked for teachings, but he would just laugh and go on his way. One day, a man who was himself known to be a Zen master of great repute came to meet him. He wanted to ascertain whether this man with a sack was really Zen or not. So he asked him, "What is Zen?" Immediately, the man dropped the sack and stood straight. Then he asked, "What is the goal of Zen? The man picked up the sack, slung it over his shoulders and walked away. This is yoga too. This is what every spiritual practice is about. When you want to attain yoga or Zen, you have to drop your load, discard everything on the way, remain free, stand upright. It is important. With your load, you may never do it. And what is the goal of yoga? Consciously take on the whole load once again. Now, it no longer feels like a load. The sacred science. What does it mean to sanctify or consecrate a space? The word consecration is often used somewhat loosely. For most people, it denotes a series of rituals that offers, at best, beauty and poetry of our lives, but performs no real useful function. Most believe it is mere mumbo-jumbo meant to obfuscate the spiritual process and exploit a fearful and gullible majority. It is time to discard this superficial understanding and look deeper. If you transform mud into food, we call this agriculture. If you make food into flesh and bone, we call this digestion. If you make flesh into mud, we call this cremation. If you make this flesh or even a stone or empty space into a higher possibility, this is consecration. Consecration is a live process. The Sanskrit word for it is pratishta. As we have discussed earlier, modern science today tells us that everything is the same energy, manifesting itself in a million different ways. If that is so, what you call the divine, what you call a stone, what you call a man or a woman, or a demon, are all the same energy functioning in different ways. If you have the necessary technology, you can make the simple space around you into a divine exuberance. You can just take a piece of rock and make it into a god or a goddess. This is the phenomena of consecration. An enormous amount of knowledge about consecration has been perpetuated across generations since ancient times, particularly in India. This is because, regardless of how good your life is or how long you live, at some point the fundamental human longing to get in touch with the source of creation will invariably assert itself. If the possibility to access these deeper dimensions is not created and made available to every individual who seeks, then that society has failed to provide authentic well-being for its citizens. It is because of this awareness that the Indian culture built numerous temples on every street. The idea was not to create temples that were in competition with one another. The idea was simply that no one should live in a space that is not consecrated. It is tremendous good fortune for a human being to live in a consecrated space. When you do, the very way you live becomes distinctly different. You may ask, "Can't I live without it?" You can. If you know how to make your very body into a temple, going to the temple is not so significant. Yes, you can consecrate your own body, but the question is, are you able to keep it that way? All spiritual initiations have been aimed at consecrating this very flesh into a temple-like space. After that, all that is needed is maintenance. Doing a spiritual practice every day is one way of trying to maintain the human system in a high state of vibrancy after an initiation. I have given powerful consecrations to people at various times, sometimes formally, sometimes informally. To consecrate an inanimate object, a rock, for example, costs an enormous amount of life. making human beings into living temples is much more inexpensive and eco-friendly. And besides, they are mobile. There are many advantages, but the problem is human beings have to dedicate a certain amount of time, energy, and focus to maintenance. Otherwise, it will not work. When people in the world are too distracted and unwilling to make themselves into living temples, building stone temples becomes a necessity. The basic purpose of building a temple is to benefit the majority of people who have no spiritual practice in their lives. If one can do some spiritual practice in such a consecrated space, it is doubly beneficial, particularly for those who do not know how to make their own body into a temple. The outer temple is invaluable. Consecration or pratishta is done in various ways, but generally by using rituals, mantras, sounds, forms, and various other ingredients. Constant maintenance is required. The rituals in the temples are not for your sake. They are to keep the deity or energy form alive. What is a deity? A deity is a tool for a specific purpose to achieve fulfillment in different aspects of life. In fact, the traditional word for a deity is yantra, which literally translates as a machine or a working energy form. Traditional wisdom has always advised people against keeping stone idols at home. If you keep them, you must maintain them every day with the right kind of processes. If a deity is consecrated through mantras, and if the necessary maintenance does not happen on a daily basis, the deity becomes a withdrawing energy and can cause immense harm to people who live in the vicinity. Unfortunately, many temples have become like this because of improper maintenance by people who do not know how to keep them alive. Prana pratishta is different in that it uses your own life energies to consecrate something. When you consecrate a form in this way, it does not need any maintenance. It is quite literally forever. When I fulfilled my mission, which was the consecration of the Dhyanalinga, a subtle energy form with all chakras operating at their optimal capacity at the Isha Yoga Center in Coimbatore, in southern India, in the year 1999. It was through prana pratishta. This is why there are no rituals in the shrine. None is required. Dhyanalinga does not need any maintenance because its vibrancy will never fluctuate. Even if you take away the stone part of the structure, it will remain the same. Irrespective of physical changes that may happen over time, the energy form will not perish. This is because the real form is made of a non-physical dimension. It is indestructible. The Indian temples were never places of prayer. The tradition was that you had a shower first thing in the morning and went directly to the temple, sat there for a while, and only then began your day. The temple was like a public battery charging space. Most people have forgotten this nowadays. They just go to the temples, ask for something, bum bounce on the temple floor, and then leave. This is quite pointless. The idea is to sit and imbibe the energies of the place. At the Dhyanalinga Yogic Temple in Coimbatore, you are not required to believe in anything to reap its benefits. You are not required to pray or make any ritual offering. You are encouraged just to close your eyes and be in the space for some time. If you were to try it for yourself, you would discover that it is a tremendous experience. Dhyanalinga is in the highest level of intensity that any form can be. Even if those who do not know anything about meditation and come and sit there, they become meditative by their own nature. This is the kind of remarkable tool it is. If I were given the necessary support and opportunity, I would like to consecrate the whole planet. This is what I am good at, turning thin air into very powerful, vibrant space, turning a piece of metal or stone into a divine reverberation. It is my dream that someday all of humanity should live in a consecrated environment. Your home should be consecrated, your street should be consecrated, your office should be consecrated, all places where you spend your time should be consecrated. When you live in such a space, your evolution need not stick to Darwinian scale. You can simply leapfrog ahead to a state of ultimate well-being and freedom. In India, most ancient temples were built for Shiva or that which is not. There are thousands of Shiva temples in the country, and most of them do not have any idol as such. They generally have a representative form, a linga. The word linga means the form. When creation began to happen, or when the unmanifest became manifest, the first form that it assumed was that of an ellipsoid, or a three-dimensional ellipse, which is what we call a linga. It started as an ellipsoid and then took on many shapes and forms. If you go into deep states of meditativeness, you will find that before a point of absolute dissolution, once again the energy takes on the form of a linga. Modern cosmologists have identified that the core of every galaxy is always an ellipsoid. So generally in yoga, the linga is considered to be the perfect and fundamental form in existence. It is the first form and the final form. In the space between, creation takes place. What lies beyond is that which is not, or Shiva. So, the linga form is actually an opening in the fabric of creation. For physical creation, the front door is a linga, and the back door is a linga. This makes the temple an opening in the fabric of the physical. You could fall right through it and go beyond. This is what makes it such a tremendous possibility. Interestingly, lingas are found all over the world. In Africa, there are terracotta lingas, largely used for occult purposes. In Delphi, Greece, there is a linga below the ground known as the navel of the earth. This is purely a Manipura linga meant to promote prosperity and material well-being. When someone showed me a picture of it, I immediately knew what type of people had consecrated this. It was definitely done by Indian yogis thousands of years ago. There is no doubt about that. When I consecrated Adi Yogi, the abode of yoga in Tennessee, in the year 2015, it was an event of considerable spiritual import. In fact, a milestone for classical yoga in the Western world. Having seen various ancient sites of interest, I am quite certain nothing of this kind of energetic significance has happened in North America or indeed in the Western Hemisphere in the last 3,000 years. Consecrated through the process of prana pratishta, the space is a tribute to Adi Yogi, the world's first yogi, exclusively dedicated to the pursuit and practice of yoga. The space represents a living repository of the highest level of energetic vibrancy and exuberance and offers a unique spiritual possibility to seekers in the West. Most of the lingas in India right now represent one chakra or two at the most. They are invariably consecrated for material well-being. There are some anahata lingas consecrated to promote peace and joy as well. The uniqueness of dhyana linga is that it has all seven chakras energized at their peak. To create seven separate lingas of seven chakras would have been so much easier, but the impact would not have been the same. So the dhyana linga is like the energy body of the most evolved being, referred to in the yogic culture as Shiva. Eternally available to all, this is the highest possible manifestation. If you push energy up to very high levels of intensity, it can hold form only until a certain point. Beyond that, it becomes formless, people are largely incapable of experiencing it. Dhyanalinga has been consecrated in such a way that the energy has been crystallized at the highest point beyond which there can be no form. It was created so that the intimacy of sitting with a live guru is available to every seeker who longs for it. Above all, what makes the Dhyanalinga an immense and unprecedented spiritual possibility is the fact that it represents the opportunity to experience life in its complete depth and totality. One who comes into this sphere is influenced on the level of akashic or etheric body or vijnanamaya kosha. If you bring about a certain transformation through physical, mental or energy body, it can be lost in the course of life. But once you are touched on the level of your etheric body, it is forever. Even if you go through many lifetimes, this seed of liberation will wait for the right opportunity to sprout and flower. It took me a 3.5 years of very intense process of consecration to complete the Dhyanalinga. Many yogis and adepts have attempted to create such a linga, but for various reasons, all the required ingredients never came together. This was not my will. It is my guru's will. Though my contact with my master was momentary, it has in every way been momentous. It has directed every step of my life, including my very birth. The Dhyanalinga has finally been accomplished with his grace and with the love, support and understanding of many people who gave of themselves knowingly or unknowingly, willingly or unwillingly, consciously or unconsciously. I am grateful to them all. Mountains of Grace. For most yogis and mystics, the problem has been that they could never share the fruits of their realization with people around them. To find another person capable of receiving what you know is not easy. If you find even one person, you are fortunate. So most spiritual masters downloaded their knowing in remote but not entirely inaccessible places. They often chose mountain peaks because there is less human traffic and disturbance in such places. There are many wonderful places like this in India. Mount Kailash, the mountain peak in western Tibet, that is regarded as a sacred place of immeasurable power and antiquity, is the place where maximum amount of knowledge has been stored for a very long time in energy form. Kailash is the greatest mystical library on the planet. Almost all the religions of the East hold it as highly sacred. Among Hindus, it is traditionally regarded as the abode of the great god Shiva and his consort Parvati. The Buddhists hold it holy because three of their great Buddhas are believed to be living there. The Jains believe their first great master or Tirthankara attained liberation there. The Bon religion, which is the original religion of Tibet, also considers it deeply sacred. I have been taking people to Kailash for the past 12 years. When I went there in 2007, my health was particularly bad. I had been traveling for weeks non-stop, during which baffled medics in different parts of the world had diagnosed me with a variety of illnesses including malaria, dengue, typhoid and even cancer. The confounded doctors termed my blood reports esoteric. Finally, I decided to look inward and work on myself. A few days later, I went to Kailash. I was better at this point, but still very weak. When I looked at the mountain, I saw there was so much mystical knowledge waiting to be accessed, so I took a strand of energy from the mountain and connected it with my energy system in a certain way. As soon as I did that, there was a sudden resurgence of vitality. and my depleted energy body, ravaged by nearly 8 weeks of fever, bounced back to normal. I looked younger, felt better, even my voice had changed, just in about an hour's time. The results were visible. There were almost 200 people around me who witnessed this. There are other places of enormous vibrational energy where mystics have bequeathed the fruits of their spiritual practice. Such spaces are innumerable in the Himalayas. A variety of mystics and yogis chose these mountains as their abode. When they lived there, they naturally left behind a certain dimension of energy. As a result, the Himalayas gathered a certain aura. For example, Kedarnath is just a small temple in the Himalayas. There is no deity there. It is just an outcrop of a rock. But it is one of the most powerful places in the world. If you strive to improve your receptivity and then visit a place like that, it will just blow you away. There are many places like that in the East, but the Himalayas attract the most people. There is another place called Kumar Parvat in southern Indian state of Karnataka. Parvat means mountain. Kumara refers to the son of Shiva, whose name was Kartikeya. He fought many battles, trying to transform the world, but when he realized the futility of this, he came to this region. It is here that he washed his sword of its blood for the last time. He decided that even if he fought for 1,000 years, he was never going to change the world, and that one violent solution would breed another 10 problems. So he climbed up the mountain and stood on the summit. Normally, when a yogi wants to shed his body, he will either sit or lie down. But because he was such a warrior, Kartikeya stood up and exited his body standing. If one can exit the physical form voluntarily, without damaging it, that is an indication of absolute mastery over the life process. This is generally referred to in the Indian tradition as Mahasamadhi, a glorious equanimity. When I went to Kumar Parvat many years ago, a small tent was set up for me. I wanted to sleep in it, but when I went in and tried to lie down, my body would involuntarily move into a standing posture, dismantling the tent. The whole night I was not able to sit, my body would only stand. That is when I started seeing what Kartikeya's life was all about. Although he lived thousands of years ago, what he left behind is still vibrantly alive. This kind of work can never be wiped out. Whenever a person does something with his life energies, he creates a certain possibility, which cannot be erased by any event. The work and presence of anybody who experimented even a little bit with the inner dimensions can never be destroyed. For example, Gautama, the Buddha, is supposed to have lived 2,500 years ago, and Jesus is supposed to have lived 2,000 years ago. But, as far as I am concerned, both are a living reality. Once you create a certain volume of work with your life energies, it is permanent for all practical purposes, and time does not destroy it. If you work with the physical body of flesh and blood, it has a limited lifespan. If you use your mind, the lifespan of that work is much longer. But if you work with your fundamental life energies, then the result is timeless. The Silver Peaks. Ever since my infancy, there was always a certain mountain peak in the background of my gaze. Only when I was 16 years old and discussed this with my friends, who responded, "You're crazy, where are the mountains?" did I realize that nobody else had mountains in their eyes. For some time, I thought I should locate that peak, but then I put the idea aside. Suppose there were a spot in your spectacles you would get used to it after a while. It was just like that with my mountain peak. It was only much later when a flood of memory returned to me, and when I was looking for a place to establish the Dhyanalinga, that I began to search for the peak that had dominated my vision. I traveled everywhere. I made the 760-mile ride from Goa to Kanyakumari on the southernmost tip of India about 11 times. Along every road and mud track, I have probably ridden thousands of miles. Then just by chance, one day, many years later, I came upon a village outside Coimbatore. As I was driving around a bend, I saw the seventh hill of the Velangiri Mountains. There it was, the mountain that I had seen since my childhood. The moment I set my eyes upon that peak, one that had lived within me for my entire life, it vanished from my inner vision and became a living reality. Suddenly, I knew this would be the most conducive space for my life work. If you ask me which is the greatest mountain on the planet, I will always reply Velangiri. I was born with an imprint of these mountains in my eyes, and they have haunted me ever since. They lived within me and have been my very own navigating system, my inner radar. The mountains are not just a matter of geography for me. They are a reservoir of all that I needed to know to create the Dhyanalinga. The word Velangiri literally means silver mountain. This range is so named because the mountains are covered with cloud for a large part of the year. They are known as the Kailash of the South because Adiyogi or Shiva himself spent a little over 3 months upon these mountain peaks. When he came here, he was not in his usual blissful mood. According to the legend, he was angry with himself because he had failed to keep his word to one of his most ardent woman devotees. He was intense and despondent, and that energy is still evident today. It produced a string of yogis through the tradition who are of the angry sort. They did their spiritual practice here and acquired that quality. They were not angry about anything in particular. They were simply in a certain state of intensity. Above all, this mountain is very important for me because this is where my guru left his body. This mountain is like a temple, a living shrine. For us in the yogic tradition, a torrent of divinity, a cascade of grace. The way of the mystic. There is a great curiosity in certain circles about mystical experiences. Many claim to have had extraordinary paranormal experiences which they cite as proof of their spiritual evolution. A common word in people's spiritual lexicons nowadays is samadhi, which is seen as a certificate of mystical attainment. What is samadhi? It is a certain state of equanimity in which intellect goes beyond its normal function of discrimination. This, in turn, loosens one from one's physical body such that there is a space between you and your body. There are various types of samadhis, which for the sake of understanding have been classified into 8 types. Among these 8, there are 2 broad categories, savikalpa, samadhis with attributes or qualities that are very pleasant, blissful and ecstatic, and nirvikalpa, samadhis that are beyond pleasant and unpleasant, without attributes or qualities. In the case of nirvikalpa samadhi, there is only a single pointed contact with the body. The rest of the energy is loose, uninvolved in the physical. These states are maintained for certain periods to help practitioners establish the distinction between themselves and their bodies. Samadhi is a significant step in one's spiritual evolution, but it is still not the ultimate. Experiencing a certain type of samadhi does not mean you are released from the cycles of existence. It is just a new level of experience. When you were a child, you experienced life in a particular way. When you move into your adulthood, you have another level of experience. You experience the same things in a totally different way at different points in your life. Samadhis are just like this. Some people may go into a certain level of samadhi and stay there for years because it is enjoyable. In this condition, there is no space or time and no bodily problems because the physical and psychological barriers have been broken to some extent. But this is only temporary. The moment they come out of this state, all the bodily needs and mental habits return once again. Generally, compared to someone who is sober, someone who is slightly drunk has a different level of experience and exuberance, but everyone still has to come down at some point. All samadhis are a way of getting high without any external chemicals. If you go into these states, a new dimension does open up for you, but the crucial thing is that it does not leave you permanently transformed. You have not moved into another reality. Your level of experience has deepened, but you have not become free in an ultimate sense. Most enlightened beings never stayed in samadhi states. Gautama the Buddha never sat and meditated for years on end after his enlightenment. Many of his disciples went into very long meditations for years, but Gautama himself never did this because he must have seen it was not necessary for him. He practiced and experienced all the 8 kinds of samadhis before his enlightenment, and he discarded them. He said, "This is not it." He knew this was not going to take him to realization. Samadhi is just a heightened level of experience, a kind of inner LSD without external input, which causes altered levels of perception. The risk is that you could get caught up with it because it is far more beautiful than the current reality, but even the most beautiful experiences, as we know, can become a drag with time. If you have made realization the top priority in your life, then anything that does not take you one step closer towards your ultimate freedom is meaningless. Let us say you are climbing Mount Everest. You will not take one step sideways because every iota of energy is needed to reach the peak. Now, if you have to reach the peak of your consciousness, you need every iota of energy you can muster. And still, it is not enough. Now, you would not want to perform any action that would distract you from the main purpose. What is this self-realization? You might wonder. After all that most people are looking for is health, well-being, wealth, love, and success. Do you really need self-realization? Let us look at this in the simplest possible way. Isn't it true that the more you know about your computer, the better you can use it? Isn't it true that your ability to use a device or an instrument is directly proportional to your knowledge about it? Isn't it true that someone with a high level of dexterity and expertise can use even a simple instrument in a seemingly magical way? Have you seen some people riding a piece of plastic that they call surfboard, doing incredible things? Just a piece of plastic, and what amazing feats of agility and grace they can perform. Similarly, the more profound your understanding of the human mechanism is, the more magical your life will be. In every culture, there have been a few people who performed certain actions that made others believe in miracles. All these actions that are known as miracles are just born of a more profound access to life that some have enjoyed. That access, as I have said time and again, is available to everyone who cares to look deeper. Tantra, a technology for transformation. Today, there are many practices associated with the occult sciences masquerading as spiritual processes. Let us say I am in India and you are in America. I want to send you a flower, but I am not willing to take the journey that Columbus took. If I make this flower suddenly land in your lap, this is occult. There is nothing spiritual about it. It is just another way of handling the physical dimension of life. In India, we have many sophisticated occult processes. There are people who can just look at a photograph and make or break a person's life. They can ensure that the person contracts some ailment that the body could not customarily have acquired in such a short span of time. These occult practices can also create health, but unfortunately, many of them use their ability in other ways, as there seems to be a better market for these negative talents. In any case, whether it is employed for ill health or good health is beside the point. The use of occult toward any self-oriented goal is inadvisable. The yogic tradition is filled with stories of the great yogi Goraknath. Some say he lived in the 11th century, but there are many accounts that date him much earlier. He was a disciple of Matsyendranath, an illustrious yogi in his own right. Such was his level of attainment that Matsyendranath was often venerated as a reincarnation of Shiva or Adi Yogi. The lore tells us that Matsyendranath lived for about 600 years. This need not be accepted literally or discarded as hagiography either. It essentially indicates an exceptionally long lifespan and tremendous awe with which this iconic figure was regarded. Goraknath became his disciple, and he adored and worshipped his master. Goraknath was all fire and intensity. Matsyendranath saw too much fire in him and not enough restraint. Fire burns through many things, so Goraknath started burning through the walls of ignorance, and suddenly he had enormous power. Matsyendranath saw that he was running a little ahead of himself, so he told him, "Go away for 14 years. Don't stay near me. You are imbibing too much from me." This was the hardest thing for Goraknath to do. If Matsyendranath had said, "Give up your life," he would have done it at once. "Go away" was something he could not bear, but since that was what his beloved master demanded of him, he went away. For 14 years, he counted the days and hours, waiting for the moment when he could return. The moment the period was over, he came rushing back. When he came, he found a disciple guarding the cave where Matsyendranath lived. Goraknath said, "I want to see my master." The yogi who was guarding the cave said, "I have no such instructions, so you had better wait." Goraknath flared up. He said, "I have waited for 14 years, you fool. I don't know when you came here. Maybe you came here the day before yesterday. How dare you stop me?" He pushed him aside and went into the cave. Matsyendranath was not there. Goraknath came back and shook the disciple and said, "Where is he? I want to see my master now." The disciple said, "I have no instructions to tell you where he is." Goraknath could not contain himself. He used his occult powers, looked into the disciple's mind, and identified where Matsyendranath was. he then started heading in that direction. His guru was waiting for him halfway. Matsyendranath said, "I sent you away for 14 years because you are beginning to become occult-oriented. You are losing sight of the spiritual process and beginning to enjoy the power that it gave you. When you come back, the first thing that you do is use your occult to open up your brother disciple's mind. Another 14 years for you." And so he sent him away again. There are many stories about Goraknath making forays into this forbidden realm and Matsyendranath punishing him again and again. At the same time, Goraknath evolved finally into the greatest disciple that Matsyendranath ever produced. This is how the practice of occult has always been treated in the yogic culture. It was never treated with respect. It was seen as a way of misusing life, of encroaching into areas where you should not. It was practiced only by certain types of people obsessed with power or money. At the same time, occult is not always a negative thing. It has earned its reputation through misuse. Occult is essentially a technology. No science or technology is intrinsically negative. If we start using technology to kill or torture people, then after some time we think, enough of this damn technology. That is what has happened to occult. Too many people misused it for personal benefit, so generally on the spiritual path, occult is shunned. What is often referred to as occult is broadly what we know as tantra. In the current understanding in society, tantra is about using very unorthodox or socially unacceptable methods. But in its classical sense, tantra simply means technology. It has nothing to do with unbridled sexuality. It is important to make a clear distinction between the occult kind of tantra and the spiritual tantra. These two were divided as left-hand tantra and right-hand tantra, and are completely different in nature. Left-hand tantra involves various rituals which may seem weirder than weird to many. The left-hand tantra is very external. You need materials and elaborate arrangements to make it happen. Occult practices, generally referred to as left-hand tantra, gave people powers to communicate across distances, to appear in two different places at the same time, and use energies to their own benefit and to the detriment of others. Right-hand tantra is more internal. It is about enabling you to use your energies to make things happen. You use all the simple aspects of life as a subjective science to turn inward and do something with yourself. The left-hand tantra is a rudimentary technology and more available to the uninitiated, while the right-hand tantra is highly refined and only available through powerful initiations. Tantra is a certain capability. Without it, there is no spiritual process. If you have no tantra in you, you have no technology to transform people. All you have are words. Words can be inspirational and directional, but not transformative. A scholar cannot be labeled a guru. Without a technology for transformation, there is no master. So there is no guru without tantra. Today there are too many people claiming to be gurus, but all they are doing is rehashing the scriptures. A true guru's work is to overhaul the entire human mechanism from acquired cyclical patterns of karma towards its ultimate possibility. It is like a mechanic's job, removing karmic warts. If there is no tantra or technology in him, you cannot call that person a guru. Serpent power. The word kundalini literally means energy. It refers to a certain type of energy within every human being, which is largely latent and unmanifest. The Kundalini has always been symbolized in the yogic tradition as a coiled cobra. A coiled cobra knows stillness of a very high quality. When the snake is motionless, it is so absolutely still that even if it is lying in your way, you will miss it. Only when it moves do you see it, but these coils hold a hidden volatile dynamism within themselves. So Kundalini is referred to as a coiled cobra because this tremendous energy exists within each and every human being, but until it moves, you never realize it is there. To live a full-fledged physical life, a minuscule amount of this physical energy is adequate. Only when the need to transcend physicality happens, do you need a burst of energy which will launch you beyond this reality. It is like the difference in the quantum of energy required in air travel and in a rocket launch. Flying within the atmosphere is one thing, and breaking the atmospheric barrier for space travel is quite another. Similarly, transcending physicality requires another dimension of energy altogether. There is not a single Indian temple where there is no image of snake. This is not because this is a culture of serpent worshippers. It signifies that a sacred space holds the possibility of arousing the unmanifest energies in you. Snakes are known to be highly perceptive creatures. Part of the reason for this, of course, is that they are stone deaf and perceive only reverberation. The snake is particularly drawn to a person who is meditative. In the tradition, it is always said that if the yogi is meditating in a place, there will be a snake somewhere nearby. If your energies become still, the cobra is naturally drawn to you. Though physically, there is a world of a difference between a snake and a human being, it is very close in terms of its energy system. If you encounter a cobra in the wild, you might find it coming into your hands without any resistance because its energies and yours are so akin to each other. Unless your chemistry shows alarm, which it interprets as danger, the snake has no intention of giving up its venom, which is its wealth, the medicinal properties of which are being increasingly acknowledged in the world today. Historically, of course, the snake has received much bad press because of the biblical story of Adam and Eve. But if you examine the tale closely, you will see it is the snake that initiated life on this planet. Otherwise, there was just a dumb couple who didn't know what to do with themselves, and you and I wouldn't have been here without that wonderful serpent. Ultimately, the rising of the Kundalini energy sets the basis for a much larger perception of life. Traditional images of Adiyogi or Shiva depict a snake with him to indicate that his perception is at its peak. Only if energy rises to a certain level of intensity and volume can reality be perceived in its utmost purity. Otherwise, every karmic imprint that we have, which goes right back to the single-celled creature that we once were, will interfere with the way we perceive reality. Joy, the beginning. Joy is a rare visitor in most people's lives. The intention of this book has been to make it your lifelong companion. Joy is not some elusive spiritual goal. It is simply the background milieu that is needed for any aspect of your life to unfold magically and wonderfully. If joy is not the ambience of your life, even life's most pleasurable activities become burdensome. The issues of life around you can be addressed to the best of your capabilities. But once joy is your constant companion, you are no more an issue in your life.